A Your Vote 2017 Maine Calling discussion about ballot question 2, expanding Medicaid in Maine. Under the Affordable Care Act, there are incentives for states to expand the number of people eligible for Medicaid, and 31 states have participated in the program. Maine is not one of them. Governor Paula Page believes that even with the federal subsidy, taking part in Medicaid expansion would cost the state too much money and would force the Department of Health and Human Services to deny care to other people in need, such as those in nursing homes and disabled people. Supporters of Medicaid expansion say there are too many people in Maine without any coverage at all, and that denying them health insurance is not only immoral, but also costs the state more in the long run. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, the debate over question 2 on the Maine ballot. What are your questions? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, a Your Vote 2017 election special. A debate over question 2 on the November ballot, which is an act to enhance access to affordable health care. The question on the ballot will read, do you want Maine to expand Medicaid to provide health care coverage for qualified adults under age 65 with incomes at or below 138% of the federal poverty level, which in 2017 means $16,643 a year for a single person and $22,412 for a family of two? Today, we'll hear from both sides of the issue. With me in the studio, Garrett Martin, who is Executive Director of the Maine Center for Economic Progress. And joining us from our Augusta studio, Brent Littlefield, who is spokesman for the Welfare to Work PAC that opposes question 2. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about ballot question 2? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And I want to emphasize that the whole reason for having both of you, Garrett and Brent, is an opportunity to answer the questions from the audience. So please call or email your questions. Garrett, I'll start with you. I always start with the group that has brought forward this ballot initiative. Why do you believe this is important for Maine?
Jennifer, this is really a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Maine to do a couple of things that are good for our neighbors, they're good for our economy, and it's good for the state. This opportunity basically means that we could provide health coverage to about 70,000 to 80,000 Mainers, and that it would draw about $500 million a year in federal funds into the state, which, as those dollars went through our economy to pay health care workers who are providing services, and then those workers in turn spend that money in our economy, the net effect would be to create about 6,000 jobs. So not only does it help boost our economy, it also provides access to much-needed health care for tens of thousands of Mainers. And it's just time to move forward with this. The legislature has passed it 5 times. The governor has vetoed it, and they've been unable to override it. There are 31 states in this country who have accepted it and have seen the benefits of it, and it's time that Maine be one of those states as well.
Okay, Brent, your turn. What's wrong with this idea?
Well, where do we begin? The issue, first and foremost, is the fact that Maine has already tried this experiment once before. It's a failed experiment in the state of Maine. Maine was one of the first states in the country to try Medicaid expansion back in 2002, 2003 as it was phasing in. And we saw the actual effects of Medicaid expansion. We experienced it in Maine. A lot of folks listening to the show, hopefully, were paying attention to politics back then and might remember that we had budget crisis after budget crisis trying to deal with this expansion. In fact, the first governor that dealt with this actually tried to delay expansion back then. I've read all the press clips going back a decade, and there was an outcry, don't stop the expansion, move forward with it. And, of course, we know what happened on the back end. After a dramatic amount of government spending, we saw several things. One, we saw a $750 million hospital debt that was dropped into the lap of the current governor, who had to solve it with a one-time special fix that can't be done again. We saw cuts to nursing homes who faced a cutback as Medicaid was expanding and those state dollars were being squeezed for nursing home care. We saw the beginning of wait lists for folks with significant disabilities that need services. Again, the state dollars were squeezed and we saw folks that needed services that weren't able to get them. And then we can look at the actual outcomes. And our organization put this out this weekend on both our Twitter feed and our Facebook page in addition to our website. noting that if you look at the U.S. Census Bureau that actually tracks health care coverage, and the state of Maine, after Medicaid expansion was phased in last time, and you look at the trend lines of the number percentage of those that had health coverage in Maine and didn't have health coverage in Maine, it literally almost stayed exactly the same for almost a decade after the expansion took place. So we saw no demonstrable change in the number of people that had health care as a percentage of the whole total within the state. So it didn't work. It cost a vast amount of money. And the folks that are supporting this, of which there are many different types of groups that are all kind of working in the same bucket, they keep talking about how it's going to help the economy. 6,000 jobs. Well, we saw the effect last time. It wasn't 6,000 new jobs. It was 300 less jobs. Specifically, the hospitals at the time noted that they had 300 less jobs, including the closing of a maternity ward as a result of Medicaid expansion and the hospital debt. So we've already seen this, and we've seen that argument just does not hold true.
Well, let me ask you about that, Garrett. I wanted to ask each of you a follow-up question, and that was what I had jotted down for you, Garrett. How do you come up with this number of 6,000 jobs?
Well, Jennifer, before I go there, I just want to respond a little bit to what Brent said, which is really I think what folks need to appreciate is that there's a little bit of a contextual amnesia about what happened in the past. In truth, Maine and the rest of the country were going through one of the worst recessions since the Great Depression, and that is actually what drove the budget challenges that both we faced here in Maine and that were faced all around the country. Another thing that's important for folks to appreciate is that the hospital debt actually began to accrue before we expanded in the past. And to the point that Brent made about sort of what happened with our insurance coverage and the fact that we didn't see a significant pickup in Maine, well, we managed to sort of hold steady while the rest of the country saw declines in coverage. So, in fact, during the time period that we expanded in previously, Maine went from the middle of the pack in terms of our coverage to sixth in the country in terms of insurance coverage. So I just think it's important that people really not just accept the information being provided by opponents on this and really stop and think about and look at what happened in the rest of the country during the same time period. And you'll see that our experience with expansion is certainly not as negative as they would portray. I think the most important thing to acknowledge, though, is that our biggest challenge previously was that we couldn't figure out how to pay for it through our own resources here in the state of Maine. And that's what's different this time. The federal government is offering to match $9 for every $1 we put up in the state. And that's ultimately what comes into our state and helps drive economic opportunity and increases in coverage. So getting back to your question about the jobs number, you know, there is very good research that shows that, you know, you grow an economy by bringing resources into your economy and then cycling them through as much as you can. And this is really one of the most unique opportunities for Maine to bring significant levels of dollars into our state that are going to pay for healthcare services for tens of thousands of people, and then that will ripple through our economy in very positive ways. The people whose jobs are being supported with these dollars are going to buy goods and services in their local economy. And I think most people on Main Street can sort of identify with that reality. And so that's where that number comes from.
Brent, the follow-up question I wanted to ask you is just that, you cite the 1990s and the Medicaid expansion that the state participated in then, but I do believe that Garrett is right, that there was not $500 million from the federal government back then, was there? Was there anything from the federal government to support Maine's former Medicaid expansion?
Yeah, yes, there was, and I'm going to address what Garrett just said and also answer your question. I like to hear Garrett talk about money sickling through the economy. It makes it sound like that Garrett's actually arguing for trickle-down economics. It's interesting to hear Garrett arguing for trickle-down economics on this program. I've assumed that he previously didn't support that. I would just point out the folks that were on Medicaid expansion previously. There's been lots of discussion about this. It's likely do not qualify for that 90% that's been discussed. Actually, we qualify for about 60%, so that further causes a problem in the state budget. But yes, there were federal funds last time Medicaid expanded in Maine. And let's just deal with what's going to happen this time. This time, no matter how you slice the apple, at a minimum, the state of Maine is going to have to pay $50 million per year for Medicaid expansion. That's the state of Maine. Maine state taxpayers listening to this program right now. Many studies show it's going to be up to $100 million per year because the projections have always been wrong in the past. In fact, the last time Maine tried to expand Medicaid, the projections were 53% off in terms of those that came in. So if you look at $50 to $100 million per year, look, if you like the days of budget crisis after budget crisis after budget crisis within the state of Maine. If you like late night arguing in front of appropriations committees and people screaming at each other, clamoring for funds because their funds are being cut, then that's what we're going to go right back to. And there's really only a few choices to come up with that money. You're either going to have a hospital debt again, you're either going to have more nursing home cuts, you're either going to have more cuts for folks with disabilities, or you can go one of two other places. One is a sales tax increase. The last time the legislature faced a major budget crunch, they went for sales tax increase. That increases taxes on everybody, including our senior citizens that are on a fixed income. The only other place to go is the largest pot of money in state government. 46% of all state funding is now in education. If you have a major budget problem, which this will cause, $50 to $100 million per year, it's likely the legislature is going to go to the biggest pot and look for some cash, and that's education in Maine. So folks that are arguing in favor of Medicaid expansion likely are arguing in favor of education cuts.
And Garrett, you did say that this is a 9-to-1 match. So if we do get $500 million from the federal government as a state, the state still has to come up with a significant share. Where do you believe the state comes up with the amount of money? Is it the $50 million? Or, you know, I know that figure is up for debate, but we'll call it $50 million. What do you believe will happen and ought to happen?
Sure. Well, thank you for the question, Jennifer. You know, the final arbiter on sort of the cost is really the Office of Fiscal and Program Review. That's the nonpartisan arm of the legislature. And they're the ones who really try to evaluate, you know, ultimately how much money is the state going to have to put on the table in order to draw down these resources to provide health coverage to tens of thousands of Mainers. And they project that over the next 2 years, it'll cost about $45 million. And then starting in 2021, $45 million over the next 2 years.
Okay.
And then once we sort of get fully on operational with this, it'll cost about $55 million starting in 2021. The interesting thing about that is that their estimate does not account for increased revenues that may result from the increased economic activity associated with bringing these dollars into the state. And the Maine Center for Economic Policy has evaluated those numbers, and basically we project that you're talking about another $27 million in additional revenue. But really the fundamental thing that's so interesting at this point in time is 3 months into the current fiscal year, we're currently running a $33 million surplus. So in truth, the resources are almost already in hand to take advantage of the first 2 years of expansion in Maine if the legislature should choose to act in accordance with the voters' wishes, assuming this gets approved on November 7th. So I think the bottom line here, though, is, again, there are no other opportunities, whether it's funding our roads, funding our bridges, any other sort of state-federal partnership to draw down, leverage the kind of resources that we're talking in this particular instance. $1 nets $9 in return from the federal government. There's no other opportunity where we've had that historically, and this is just something that we shouldn't pass up for the state of Maine, for our people.
Brent, let me pose the question this way. Every time we do a Maine Calling program that has anything to do with health care coverage, we get calls from people who kind of fall into this hole where they have jobs, but the job doesn't provide insurance. They make too much money to qualify for Medicaid, but don't make enough money to qualify for a subsidy under the ACA. The numbers vary about how many people fall into this hole, but I know that there are people out there because they call this program. Somewhere between 50 to 70,000 people is what I've heard. If this does not pass, what do you believe is the best solution for those Mainers who do work but don't have access to health insurance?
So you made a good point there, Jennifer, in terms of saying 50 to 70,000. The numbers vary because you've got advocates that sort of throw out a figure. But now we have the Maine Hospital Association actually produced their own document several years ago that showed that a goodly number of that group actually would qualify for private health care on the exchange today. So these numbers are very fungible. This is an ongoing problem. The problem cannot be solved with Medicaid expansion because it doesn't work. We saw that it didn't work before. Again, we're talking about folks that need coverage, and we can have this revisionist history of, well, let's look at what happened in other states. We can look at what happened in Maine, according to the Census Bureau, and that the percentage of those that are insured in the state barely changed after Maine spent a drastic amount of state money, not federal money, state money, like it would have to again, to expand Medicaid. So this is not really the solution to the problem. And secondarily, I'll add that one thing that's forgotten, and we just heard Garrett talk about, well, you know, there's going to be additional tax revenues and the tax revenues are going to come in. One thing that's forgotten in this discussion a lot is that in Maine, hospitals are nonprofits. All of them are. And they're all nonprofits for one reason, and that's because on their balance sheets, they can avoid paying all taxes. So there actually aren't taxes being paid by that spending. They avoid sales taxes. They avoid income taxes. And if you look at what's happened with the hospitals, I hate to say this, I bring up this argument here, but it's just a fact. If you look at cuts that have happened in hospitals in the past, we still have massive CEO salaries. We've got that actually detailed on our website, mainvoteno on2.com. And we note the types of salaries we're seeing from these quote-unquote nonprofit hospitals in Maine. If you look at a 2009 news report, I believe it's from the Portland Press Herald, they noted that when bonuses and other compensation were added to the equation, the average pay for a top Maine hospital CEO was $480,328 per year back in 2009. So these hospitals don't pay taxes, and in return, they're supposed to be providing charity care. That's the trade-off. You save hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes. You're supposed to provide charity care. And now you have some hospitals sort of saying, well, yes, we know we're supposed to do that. We still want to be a nonprofit. We still want to provide these CEO salaries, but we also want to bring in other dollars as well from the taxpayers. And it's hard to have that argument without having an honest discussion about where the money actually goes within these large kind of corporate-style organizations that are being run as nonprofits.
Garrett, we're having this discussion about expanding Medicaid with monies that have been made available through the Affordable Care Act at the same time that the future of the Affordable Care Act is anything but certain.
Right.
If Maine people pass this and Medicaid expansion goes through, what kind of guarantee do we have? And my guess is none, that it will really mean anything in the long term.
Well, Jennifer, before I answer that question, I do want to come back to the question you raised about people who currently don't have any affordable health care options, because I think that's something that maybe gets lost in this debate, which is because of a sort of what happened with the Supreme Court and the Affordable Care Act, what it means is states were given the choice as to whether or not they expanded Medicaid. And regrettably, for the states where that didn't happen, it really means that there are tens of thousands of people who have no other affordable health care options. And many of these people are working. I mean, in the case of Maine, you know, there's a woman who's been a spokesperson for the campaign, Kathleen Phelps, who's done hair for 30 years. She has COPD and needs oxygen. She doesn't qualify for Medicaid. She's too young for Medicare, and she can't afford her private insurance premiums. I mean, she's really having to choose between paying her bills and oxygen. And somebody like her is somebody who could benefit from this. And without it, there really is no other option. So I think, you know, fundamentally, there is a human story behind this issue. And it's one that I think it's easy to sort of talk about the big numbers and the big picture that way, but we shouldn't lose sight of that. It really is healthcare for our neighbors. But to your question about sort of there's no guarantee in the future, you're right. You know, there is no guarantee in the future. You know, luckily, we have some evidence, recent evidence, suggesting that at least in the case of Maine, our senators, Angus King and Susan Collins, will stand up for what's right and protect these kinds of opportunities to assure that people who are taking advantage of these programs can count on them to be there into the future. But certainly, you know, the political winds shift, and we'll have to find other solutions at such time as we need to. The point is, though, this is the opportunity before us now. And, you know, we've taken a pass on it for the last 3 years. But I think the evidence has clearly shown that we really are missing the boat by not doing so. And that's what's most important, because it, once enacted, can really deliver health coverage to over 70,000 people and have an immediate boost to our economy.
The voice you just heard is Garrett Martin with the Maine Center for Economic Progress. Also joining us today, Brent Littlefield, the spokesman for the Welfare to Work PAC that opposes Question 2. We do have to go to a break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Humanities Council, offering Letters About Literature, a national reading and writing contest for 4th to 10th graders. Learn more at mainehumanities.org. And Nancy Marshall Communications, a Maine-based public relations firm with global reach, working to connect businesses and nonprofits with their targeted audiences.
On the next Fresh Air, the life and death of Eric Garner. Matt Taibbi has a new book about the man who died in 2014 at the hands of police.
He's on the ground. He has people on top of him. He has an arm around his neck, and he's saying 11 times, "I can't breathe," and that's how he dies.
Taibbi examines Garner's life, the police practices that led to his death, and the legal battles that followed.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 right here on Maine Public Radio. Many businesses and organizations in and around Maine join listeners in supporting various public radio programs on Maine Public Radio. You hear their mentions every day. To learn how your business can benefit from supporting Maine Public Radio and Classical, Maine Public Television, or MainePublic.org, please visit our website, MainePublic.org. Click on About and then Business Support. Or you can call us at 1-800-884-1717 and ask for Susan Tran. That number again, 1-800-884-1717. And of course, thank you for your support of public broadcasting here in Maine.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, a Your Vote 2017 discussion of ballot question two, whether Maine should expand Medicaid. With me in the studio, Garrett Martin, who is executive director of the Maine Center for Economic Policy. And joining us from our Augusta studio, Brent Littlefield, spokesman for the Welfare to Work PAC that opposes question two. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief, please brief, email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll start in Acton with Mike. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. A couple of things. First, I'd like to say I am pro-Medicaid expansion. It makes no sense to not at least do what we can now to expand it, and this is an opportunity that takes less out of the state budget than the previous madness. That said, I take issue with Mr. Littlefield's couple of his comments. When he mentions the trickle-down economics to Garrett's comment, that's not that kind of economy is not trickle-down. That's circular. That goes from one working stiff to another working stiff. The trickle-down theory is what trickles down from the big corporations, big money, the deep pockets. Second point being, he befuddles, just throws out a red herring about the salaries by the CEOs of these healthcare. That's a minor detail. I mean, what does that equate? All the monies that they get equate to $500 million in help. So, you know, basically, I just don't see any reasonable argument to not do this.
All right, Brent Littlefield.
Well, again, I can only go to the reasonableness of where we're going to pay for this. I didn't hear the caller make any comment about where the money would come from. He just said that there would be a lesser cost possibly to the state government than the past. There's actually no indication that that's going to be the case, but he didn't say where he paid for it. Again, the largest single pot of money in state government is education spending. That's 46% of the entire budget when you include everything. I don't know if the caller would want to go to that large bucket and cut education spending to pay for this, or go back again and cut nursing homes, which is what happened in the past, or funding for the disabled. The money has to come from somewhere, and that's really the issue here. And to say that we can rely upon the federal government, I think, is a misnomer as well. Just before we went to break, Garrett mentioned Senator Collins. Maybe he missed her announcement regarding a potential run for governor, where she spent almost 12 minutes of her speech talking about the problems and failures of Obamacare, and went on and on and on about how the law is not working and how it needs to be fixed. So there's likely going to be some type of change. We don't know what type of change in Washington. And although it would be quote-unquote under Obamacare, it could affect all health care. And we have to remember that the federal government is massively in debt. We have a massive, massive federal deficit and a massive federal debt. And to assume that the federal government is going to continue to keep picking up a certain percentage of spending is a misnomer. We've seen time and time again with federal programs that the federal government changes funding formulas. So we can't live on that. And we also know that because Medicaid was expanded in Maine in the past and that failed expansion, that Maine wouldn't get the same percentage of reimbursement other states have gotten. So this is a complicated issue, but what's not complicated is at a minimum, the state government in Maine, state taxpayers, will have to come up with between $50 and $100 million per year when fully implemented, and there is no source of that funding today, and the money will have to come from somewhere.
Garrett.
Well, I think that the reality is, obviously, you don't get something for nothing, and you have to evaluate where your best investment opportunities are. And this really represents, again, a once-in-a-generation investment opportunity for our state to invest in our people, invest in our economy, and achieve some better results all around. So I think the ship has sailed in terms of the rhetoric about what's worked, what hasn't worked. The reality is this is the option that Maine voters have a choice to make a decision on next week on November 7th. And, you know, we can look to other states to appreciate the value of this. 31 states have expanded. None have decided to withdraw. Many of those states have been led by Republican governors and Republican legislative bodies. You know, and this not only provides benefits in terms of the people who directly get health coverage, but it helps a whole host of other people. Again, going back to the Office of Fiscal and Program Review, one of the things that they identify, and we saw this in the data for Maine ourselves, which is that about 5,000 children are likely to gain coverage if we choose to expand Medicaid. And the reason for that is because we previously, under the current administration, made a choice to cut health coverage for working parents. And it turns out that when a parent loses their health coverage, their children are more likely to lose their health coverage as well. And so by expanding Medicaid, we actually have the ability to bring those people back online and also help their children get access to the coverage that they need too. The other thing, though, is, you know, anyone who's buying insurance in the healthcare marketplace, and I know you all are having a show on this about the enrollment process, and I can't stress enough the importance of people going on and trying to get into the enrollment side. Premiums in states that have expanded are 7% lower than states that have not. So, again, there are just so many benefits associated with this that have been well documented based on the experience of other states under the current conditions, not under some past historic thing, which is an apples and oranges kind of comparison. And I think it's really important that Maine voters acknowledge that and account for that when they make their choice on November 7th.
Mike, I appreciate your call. And before I go to another call, Garrett, I'm going to give you a chance to respond to what Garrett said about other states. I know that he made the point, and I think it's a good one, that 31 states have expanded Medicaid, and none of those who have expanded have chosen to reverse that decision. But you also see problems in some of the states that have expanded Medicaid, correct?
We do. And again, Maine has its own unique experience with this and its own unique problems. And again, you can say the ship has sailed. The ship hasn't sailed. The ship sailed into debt, which will happen again. In addition to that, I would just add that, you know, he mentions children I would call that a red herring, in that Medicaid already covers children. It covers children. Medicaid currently covers a pregnant woman. It covers seniors that need extra care. Medicaid already covers those folks. This is expanding Medicaid to working age people that are not disabled. But let's look at what's happened in some other states. There was a story in public radio. Since we're on public radio, I will reference that. West Virginia Public Radio, May 23rd, 2016. The headline on the story is Medicaid expansion contributing to the West Virginia budget crisis. And quoting from that story, the cost to West Virginia next year will be almost $1 billion, and every year that goes up. In April of just this year in Oregon, and the state's largest newspaper, I believe that was the Oregonian, they quoted and they said, Oregon's economy soars, yet state budget gap grows, and here's why. Quote, healthcare costs largely due to Oregon's Medicaid expansion threw the state's books off by $1 billion in the next budget cycle. Modern Healthcare News then reported that Democratic lawmakers, not Republican lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers in Oregon are considering ending the state's Medicaid expansion in an effort to address a $1.6 billion budget shortfall. So these are just two other states. We could look at other states as well. And remember, some states got waivers. So some states actually implemented a different type of quote-unquote Medicaid expansion than what's being discussed here in Maine. And we, again, could go back to our Maine experience. I don't mind mentioning these other states. It's fine to do so. But let's talk about what's actually happened in Maine. Again, you know, the old saying, I think my grandmother used to say this, that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing again and expecting a different result. We tried Medicaid expansion in Maine. I'm sure some of the same advocates that are pushing it now were pushing it back then. And we saw what resulted. And again, cuts to nursing homes, cuts to people with disabilities, a $750 million hospital debt, and the U.S. Census Bureau reports almost a no percent change,
so
very minimal.
Let me jump in there now, Brent. You say we saw cuts to nursing home, but those are not directly related. There was nothing in the law, in the legislature did not pass anything that mandated cuts to nursing homes. That was a decision.
What happens with nursing homes is that it goes back to the issue of Medicaid and goes back to federal reimbursements. And decisions were made that they could receive, the state legislature decided they could receive more money from Washington if they kept the other Medicaid expansion and reduced funding to nursing homes. They also put in place back in the 2000s what was called a tax and match scheme, which was kind of a very bizarre situation where they required nursing homes to tax its own residents and then turn around and take that tax and try to use it in a scheme to get more money out of Washington and put it back in the nursing homes.
Sure,
it
but
really,
that's
quite
not
frankly,
in place
it was
right
quite
now.
Frankly, it was quite frankly a mess. And all we have to do is look at, we'll give you one example out of many. Phil Sear, who manages the nursing home in Caribou, wrote an op-ed to the Bangor Daily News just a couple years ago and talked about the fact that the state was cutting funding to nursing homes at the same time that it expanded Medicaid to young people who were of working age. He experienced it. He lived through it. And he also ran the visiting nurses in Aroostook County for almost 18 years.
But
these are
real
life impacts.
This is the experience that we had in the past, but it is not mandated that this would happen again. This is, in your view, what could happen again, but it is not something that would automatically happen.
Can you look at the past? And also, although they try to come back and say that the governor reversed herself, a Democratic governor in New Hampshire just a couple years ago, faced with Medicaid expansion problems, offered, it was her choice, she could have chosen anything, offered a $7 million cut to nursing homes in New Hampshire, came back later and said, well, we can put $4 million back in of the $7 million that was going to be cut in New Hampshire. So it didn't just happen in Maine in the past. It's actually happened in other states since then as well that have experienced this Medicaid expansion.
So, Jennifer, I just think this is really an important point because the core of their argument is based on what happened in the past. And I think there are a couple of things that are really important for folks to appreciate. For starters, when the cuts that are being referenced to long-term care took effect, that was during the recession. There were cuts happening elsewhere in the budget. And in fact, we actually froze the increase in coverage to childless adults that was part of that previous Medicaid expansion effort. So it wasn't like we were expanding willy-nilly while we were cutting everywhere else. We were making very difficult budget choices as a result of the recession's impact on our state revenue picture. With regard to New Hampshire, that's a very interesting talking point because the reality is if you go back and you look at what has happened there, what has driven their cost challenge is not Medicaid expansion. It was an increase in children entering their Medicaid program beyond what they expected and the fact that the state had to make a payment on a settlement on mental health services. So to suggest that the Medicaid expansion is the source of all our fiscal woes is just not accurate and is not borne out by the facts.
All right, I'm going to move on to John.
Okay,
who's
Jennifer,
calling.
I just –
Okay, hold,
Jennifer,
John,
just
one, you hold one on, quick, Garrett. Go ahead.
One quick comment here. The Boston Globe reported the cut to nursing homes in New Hampshire was directly attributable to Medicaid expansion. That's the Boston Globe. And in 2014, again, that was just recently, 2014, Rhode Island's Providence Journal reported that the governor there proposed cutting nursing homes to help close a $150 million budget hole, which was contributed to Medicaid expansion as well. So, again, these are recent examples since they brought up other states, in addition to the experience we had directly in Maine last time we expanded Medicaid.
John and Wes Baldwin, go ahead.
Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks for putting me on the show. I'm calling about opioids and ER visits today. I've noticed some of the ads in favor of expansion talk about how expansion would reduce the opioid problem in the state and would reduce ER visits. I recently read an interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal entitled, "Does Medicaid Spur Opioid Abuse?" which states that opioid proliferation as well as ER visits rather have increased far more in those states that have expanded Medicaid. And it also says that opioid prescription rates to Medicaid recipients in the ER far outpaces prescription rates to other patients. I wondered if your panelists could comment on how Medicaid expansion would reduce opioid abuse and ER visits and what evidence we have that that would happen.
Garrett?
Well, I think, you know, this is an interesting point. And the one thing that's important to bear in mind is that the opioid crisis actually started 15 years before where we are now. And, you know, what we do know is that Medicaid expansion will improve access to treatment for people who are struggling with that addiction. It will also provide access to preventive care for people so that potentially they're able to deal with their pain and manage their health issues so that they don't wind up finding themselves in the midst of an opioid crisis. You know, I think the reality is the data's not there yet to know one way or the other how this issue shakes out long term. But I think most people intuitively appreciate that The path to recovery is one that does include access to appropriate services and health coverage, and that's certainly what this is fundamentally about.
Brent?
Well, we like to look at facts and data, not feeling. And we can't keep saying that things have happened in the past shouldn't affect the future. And you just mentioned something happened 15 years ago, where we can look at the past and the future. And I thought that Wall Street Journal article was extremely telling and quite disturbing. And I recommend that folks read that. It's actually on our Twitter feed for Welfare to Work. It specifically attributed increased problems with opioid addiction directly to states that had Medicaid expansion. And I'm sure that's pretty difficult for folks to hear that want Medicaid expansion. I'd encourage you to go back and read that article again and look at it, because they covered quite a bit of data in that column.
I think one thing that's really important about that article people should bear in mind is that they don't actually do a control to assess what the levels of addiction were prior to expansion in those states and what the levels subsequently were. I think that's a really important point. The other sort of piece of data, though, that's very germane to this discussion, too, is, again, we have seen in states that have expanded that there has actually been a 40% decline in bad debt and charity care for hospitals. Again, that is based on the experience in the 31 other states that have expanded. And, yes, can you cherry-pick examples of one state that didn't quite achieve that mark or one state that fell below it? Absolutely. But the broad experience, the one that is most defensible, says that this really does make sense for those care providers and for their economies.
And can I just add one thing there, Jennifer? This is Brent. We just heard a really important point made by the other side. This happens in the legislature all the time in Augusta before the Appropriations Committee. You should plan on, if we did expand, you should plan on hearing this a lot when we're going through these budget crises trying to figure out how to pay for this. They just lumped together bad debt and charity care. Bad debt and charity care. Those are two separate issues that consistently get lumped together within the legislature. Charity care, again, is supposed to be provided by Maine hospitals. Maine hospitals, all of which are nonprofit, receive massive reductions in cost because they don't pay taxes. And in return, the agreement for that is that if you're going to be a nonprofit, you're required to provide charity care. That money that would be spent in taxes is supposed to be spent on charity care. But some, again, very big pay CEOs would like to take the taxpayer money in addition to the other money that they're supposed to be spending on charity care.
Okay, Brent, thank you. And we do have to take a quick break. But before we go there, a word about tomorrow's program. We're going to have another Your Vote 2017 program. And tomorrow we will be discussing ballot question one, whether to allow slot machines or a casino in York County. If you'd like to email your question or post it on Facebook ahead of time, you are welcome to. You are listening to Maine Calling, and we'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Maine Audubon, a community of people who understand that when Maine's wildlife thrives, Maine thrives. Learn more at maineaudubon.org.
Across the U.S., an affordable housing crisis means some tenants have to fend for themselves in rundown private rentals.
Houses falling off their foundations, walls that don't connect anymore, rooms where you look through and the seams of the walls, you could see light from the outside.
I'm Ari Shapiro. A new investigation from NPR and Frontline on the challenges of housing the poor, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Speaking in Maine, the biennial 2017 Cohen Lecture.
Now, several U.S. presidents can be considered unconventional. Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, FDR, and Harry Truman.
Tweeting did not exist when I was serving President Reagan, President Bush, or President Bush.
Renowned diplomats joined former Secretary of Defense William Cohen to address this year's subject, assessing the first year of an unconventional presidency. You can hear the discussion on Speaking in Maine, Monday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a Your Vote 2017 discussion about ballot question two, which is Medicaid expansion. Joining me today, Garrett Martin, who is executive director of the Maine Center for Economic Policy. And joining us from our Augusta studio is Brent Littlefield. He is spokesman for the Welfare to Work PAC that opposes question two. Join our conversation. Give us a call. 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We have an email from Michael. He writes, since folks who earn above the poverty level can already get insurance from Obamacare individual markets, why are you forcing everyone between 100% and 130% of the poverty level to leave that plan where they get choices about the coverage they buy and switch to Medicaid, where the government controls everything about the coverage. Why not just expand coverage to folks who aren't eligible for insurance under Obamacare? So a whole lot there, Garrett, and I think it just shows some of the confusion about this issue. Would some of the people who currently get care under ACA subsidies then be forced to switch to Medicaid if this were passed?
It's certainly the case that people who are eligible to be covered under Medicaid, who may be getting coverage currently through the health insurance exchange, could be wind up on the Medicaid rolls. But, you know, I think one thing that's really important in that conversation is the population that we're talking about. Historically, that is a population that has, you know, at or near the poverty line, that has had difficulty maintaining private insurance coverage. So, you know, while it may be the case that 1 week they have that option available to them, any change in their circumstance then puts them out of luck as it relates to maintaining that coverage. And so, you know, certainly the Affordable Care Act is not a perfect law. Certainly there are a lot of things that can be fixed about it. But, you know, to suggest that we should not provide any coverage options to about the people who fall below the poverty line, who have no other options available to them, just to preserve a current system that may or may not be working for folks. And we know, again, there are a lot of people above the 100% poverty level who don't have any coverage, who are not getting it through the private insurance market. So there are more people who stand to gain at the end of the day.
All right, Brent?
Well, again, those folks do have at least a coverage option with the charity care from the hospitals, which they're required to provide as a return for their nonprofit status. But I'm glad that that Garrett here actually admitted the fact that there would be folks that would be taken off private insurance rolls and put into government-funded Medicaid, state taxpayer-funded Medicaid, if this passed. And that is a fact. And we should also talk about the fact that those folks that would do that are going to be going to facilities for coverage and actually paying lower reimbursement rates. It's kind of one of those interesting phenomenons because if someone is actually on quote-unquote private insurance now and they switch to Medicaid, the amount of money that the local doctor, for instance, would earn would actually be less than what they earn under the private care, and yet the state taxpayers would be paying more.
We'll go to Angela, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Angela. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to address the commentator's comments regards to the false narrative around charity care. I actually work in the healthcare industry, and I think this is a narrative that gets tossed around quite a bit, that somehow charity care is paid for by some sort of mythical account that hospitals or other healthcare entities like FQHCs have. There is no mythical account that covers charity care. Unfortunately, what happens is that the more charity care there is, the more that either needs to be passed on to the other consumers that can actually and have the luxury of having insurance, or hospitals, health centers end up needing to make layoffs or do without other items.
All right, Brent?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what her role or job has been, obviously in advocating for a political campaign today. But let me just quote from statistics. There is a medical journal called MedPage Today, which reported, quote, nonprofit hospitals have higher profit margins than most for-profit hospitals. They pay no property tax, no federal or state income tax, and no sales tax. Health Affairs Journal found that 7 of the 10's most profitable hospitals were nonprofit, each earning more than $163 million from patients. All main hospitals are nonprofit, as I noted before. And a Portland Press Herald story in 2013 titled Amid Cuts, Maine Hospitals Still Paying $1 Million Salaries, reported that CEOs at Maine's nonprofit hospitals earned an average salary, as I mentioned before, $339,000. And when you include salaries and bonuses, up to $480,328 per salary on average throughout the state. So there's plenty of money in some of these health systems. And again, that money that saved in taxes is supposed to go to charity care.
I want to talk, though, about the idea of charity care. And, Brett, I'm going to put this back to you. You know, when somebody has, you know, we hear this over and over again, that having someone use the emergency room as their doctor is really the worst kind of health care that you can get, instead of getting care for something as it's getting worse, you know, nipping a problem in the bud, waiting until the problem has gotten really, really bad is really far more expensive for the healthcare system. So is having people not have health insurance others, but waiting until they're very sick and going to the emergency room really the goal that we're going for?
Well, let me give you some statistics again. U.S. Government National Institutes of Health, as detailed in an expansive article in Science Magazine, looked specifically at Medicaid expansion in Oregon related to the exact question that you're talking about. The largest study on Medicaid expansion directly related to the issue you're talking about. And it showed that expansion produced no detectable change in physical health, employment, or earnings, and that expansion actually increased emergency room department visits by 40% in the first 15 months, including increases in visits for conditions that could have been treated less expensively elsewhere. So the concept that Medicaid expansion will actually reduce more costly treatments has actually been proven false by the U.S. Government Centers for National Institutes for Health. So it's been studied, it's been looked at, and it just doesn't work.
All right. Garrett, thoughts?
Well, I think, again, that's one example, and it's on a very limited time horizon. I think most people intuitively get that if you get people the preventive care they need, that's going to prevent some longer-term challenges. But what I'd like to come back to a little bit, which is this idea, again, around the bad debt and charity care, and what we know from the experience of the 31 other states is that there has been a reduction there. But more importantly is what this means at the local level. And I think, you know, folks in rural Maine certainly have seen healthcare services decline in recent years. And part of the reason for that decline has been the fragile state of the finances of their local hospital. And part of the reason why the finances of their local hospital have been imperiled is in part because of the state's refusal to expand Medicaid and the incumbent costs that they have had to incur as a result. Similar to what the caller said, that doesn't come for free, and those costs ultimately have to be passed along to somebody else, which is typically comes in the form of either reductions in services or higher premium costs for everybody else. So, you know, I think, again, if people think about what's happening in their own communities, think about what's happening with their neighbors, they can appreciate the dynamics that play out in this situation. And again, these are all dynamics that I think are well supported by plenty of evidence that show that you have reductions in mortality when people have access to better health care. And in fact, the Harvard School of Public Health found 6% reduction in mortality rates between selected expansion and non-expansion states. So, you know, we can play dueling statistics all day long. But I think fundamentally this issue is about looking out for our neighbors, looking out for our economy, and doing what's in the best interest of our state.
Angela, thanks for your call. We're going to move on to Ellsworth and Greg. Hi, Greg. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm an orthopedic surgeon in Ellsworth, and I wanted to point out two things. One, Maine Care frequently does not provide reimbursement that covers the cost of care that I provide. So I believe that expanding Maine Care basically shifts the cost burden to the providers. And secondly, free care doesn't always work. I treat Maine Care patients, and we frequently have a slot for a Maine Care patient. The patient doesn't show up, so we started scheduling two patients for that slot, and frequently that slot remained open. We started allowing for three patients per slot, and sometimes we get one patient, sometimes we don't. The care is treated as though it's free, and it's not appreciated.
Interesting thought. Garrett.
You know, I'm not going to speak to the experience of one individual physician in that challenge. I do think that the reality is it is true that there are a lot of issues that play out in people's lives that we have no understanding of until we've walked a day in their shoes. And there are tens of thousands of Mainers who are working, but can't provide for their families and are unable to access the health care they need to treat chronic long-term conditions. And this is an opportunity to help address those concerns. You know, I don't know about you, Jennifer, but, you know, in my local community, I am sick and tired of seeing that coffee can at the counter of my local convenience store asking for a few nickels, dimes, pennies to provide to help pay for the hospital care of somebody who had a tragic health event or some other chronic condition crop up in their lives. You know, this is an opportunity, again, where we can do something that is good for our neighbors, it's good for our economy, and it's good for the state.
Brent?
Well, I've heard a lot about what's good and what's intuitively good and what feels good and a pushback against the actual statistics that I quoted from the U.S. government and elsewhere. Again, and just continue to quote statistics, as I said at the beginning of the program, and I say again, the U.S. Census Bureau showed the last time Maine expanded Medicaid, there was no detectable percentage change and the folks that actually had health coverage in the state. And I don't think we can dismiss what the doctor just said, which is the negative impacts that he's felt from the program. You know, look, it's not worked in the past. The statistics show it does not work. We still in this program have proven that no one has a solution to where the money would actually come from to pay for this from the state level. We saw the negative impacts when the cost went up before. And as it relates to these rural hospitals, look, I was born and raised in one of the most rural areas in the entire state of Maine. I'm very familiar with it. I go there regularly. I have family there. That hospital's had issues, but all of those hospitals have had massive issues when we had a $750 million hospital debt as a result of the last Medicaid expansion. And they came crying out to the state legislature and the governor to please pay off that debt because 300 jobs were lost, a maternity ward was closed, medical innovation was cut back. So again, we went down this path. It was a bad path. It failed. And now we're right back with some of the same folks arguing we should do it all over again.
All right, we're going to go to Veronica in Waldoboro. Veronica, we're short on time, so if you could make your comment or ask your question quickly, that'd be great.
Well, 37 years in healthcare as a nurse and traveled quite extensively around the world, and all I can say is we need universal healthcare if you want to cut to the point. The welfare to work, we already have a system like that. That doesn't solve the overall health problems, and especially when you might get a job like and you're in that gap area and cannot afford insurance or get insurance. So, yeah.
Okay.
Universal coverage.
Thank you, Veronica. And Brent, since you're opposing this measure, it is, you have to acknowledge, a big problem in Maine that many, many people who work very hard also do not have health insurance.
Well, again, all I can say, Jennifer, is we tried it before, and that percentage of people you're discussing barely budged after literally hundreds of millions of dollars in spending. So again, we're talking about this specific program and whether this specific program can solve the problem. We tried it before, and it did not solve that problem.
Okay, and very briefly, Garrett.
You know, Jennifer, again, the hospital debt started before we expanded, before Maine's performance during one of the worst recessions was better than other states in the country. But most importantly, the opportunity before Mainers now is to provide access to coverage for over 70,000 people and to leverage over $500 million for our state.
Okay. Well, thank you both so much for being here. We'll see you again, I hope, for our television debate about this topic. Brent Littlefield is a spokesman for the Welfare to Work PAC that opposes Question 2, and Garrett Martin is the executive director of Maine Center for Economic Policy. Nikki Shields ran the board today. We had additional help from Mal Leary. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives, at mainecalling.org. Today's program will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Stay with Maine Public for all sorts of coverage. It will be under mainepublic.org/yourvote if you'd like to listen to this program again or have access to our other coverage of ballot issues. Tomorrow on the program, a conversation about ballot question 1, whether to allow slot machines or a casino in York County. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.